All right. Our final oral argument this morning is the State of Minnesota versus Flores. The file number is 821-1749. As all parties are aware, counsel for the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Counsel for the respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, counsel for the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This matter is being recorded. However, our rules prohibit anyone from making a private recording, either any observers, parties, or counsel. So please keep that in mind. For counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel, my name is Robert Yount, and I represent the state as the appellant in this matter. Now, the matter before the court today is a state's pretrial appeal, and it's important to note from the outset that on probable cause challenges under Rule 11 of criminal procedure, the state is entitled to the most deferential burden of proof that's available throughout the criminal process. The question here is not whether there is proof beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime. It's not even whether there's clear and convincing evidence or even whether there's a preponderance of evidence. It's more deferential than that. The question at this stage is whether there is just a reasonable probability that Mr. Flores acted grossly negligent or negligent on November 30th, 2019. And the district court below respectfully erred in its finding. Now, on the record, there are a number of factors that are fully briefed, but in essence, they boil down to two primary guiding factors that show gross negligence or negligence. That is that there's evidence showing that he was driving too fast for the weather and the inclement conditions, and that he was driving distractedly. And the linchpin, or I should say the keystone of both of those two primary guiding factors, is the testimony from Ms. Droge, or a CD identified in the briefs. She is the person who had firsthand observations, and she was the firsthand witness of his conduct immediately before and leading up to and during the incident. And it's important to break down what she saw, because all of the other circumstantial evidence that is in the record and that must be construed in favor of the state folds in and ties in with her testimony. So in a sense, the circumstantial evidence in the record supports what she saw. So going back to about 2.5 minutes before the incident, she was traveling eastbound on Main Street. She saw Mr. Flores turn onto Main Street near her, where there was approximately a 40 mile per hour speed limit. It is at that point in time, as they are approaching the Highway 10 overpass, that she sees distracted driving. She describes that he jerks over into her lane on two separate occasions. She later told officers that he was hovering over the dotted line of the lanes, and that she described he was driving as if he appeared like he was on his phone. So all of this, while not perhaps the strongest evidence of distracted driving, it is statements to officers that effectively say she saw someone driving distractedly for about a mile leading up to the Highway 10 overpass. And then what she describes is what happens after the Highway 10 overpass. So after the Highway 10 overpass, the speed limit goes up to 55. She says that she increases to 50 miles per hour. And then she uses the phrase that at that point in time, he sped up and got in front of her. So now you transition into the other factor, which is there is circumstantial evidence in the record that he was traveling too fast for the weather. So before she describes...
Before we get to the speed, do you mind if I interrupt and ask you about the distracted driving, just so I understand the facts and what you're saying her statement was? Was it distracted? How does the... Either temporarily or also just geographically, when he moved toward her lane and jerked back or jolted back... I can't remember the exact word that was used. How far in advance of the site of the spin out was that? Was that 1 to 2 miles?
Yes, it's within 2 miles. If you look at just a geographical map, the Highway 10 overpass serves as a helpful halfway marker, because that was about eight tenths of a mile before the incident. And she told officers that for about a mile before the Highway 10 overpass is where she saw Mr. Flores driving. So this court, in effect, looks at a 2 mile distance on Main Street, a mile before the overpass, a mile after the overpass, and about a 2.5 minute period.
And so the straying in toward her lane, encroaching toward her lane, was a mile or two or 1 to 2 miles before the spin out?
Right. So more than a mile before the incident happened is where she testified about the jolting and the drifting over the line and observing what she described as him, as if he was appeared he was on his phone. And then within the mile leading up to the incident, that's where she says that he sped in front of her. And then what she describes to the officers is the following, is that she increases because the speed limit increases. So she's driving about 50 miles an hour. Sorry.
I didn't have any questions.
Oh, sorry. So she says that she increases to about 50 miles an hour and that he increases to 50 to 55 miles an hour. And so the district court looked at that and said, well, she was driving about the same distance. But what it glossed over is her statement that before the incident, this is important, within the mile before the incident, she felt that she needed to pull back a little. That was her statement to the officers. So she pulled back a little because she thought that he was driving too fast and that she thought that her 50 miles per hour was too fast for the weather.
So let me just pause here and ask about this speed. Because part of this is what does the evidence reasonably support, I guess, in terms of what his maximum speed was. And I was confused by something I want you to answer. When I look at the district court's order and the factual findings, so on addendum 3, paragraph 11, it says, at the time of the accident, CD, an eyewitness to the accident, explained to law enforcement who was on the scene that her, meaning she, and Flores were going 45 to 50 miles per hour just prior to Flores fishtailing. And then if you go into the paragraph 14, says, while her statement contemporaneous with the accident, 45 to 50, differs slightly from her later statement to law enforcement up to 55, the court views her responses about traveling at 55 to be earlier, 1 to 2 miles earlier than where the spin out occurred. And then when you go to addendum 6, paragraph 8, again talking, this is all about CD's speed, the district court in its conclusion says, as CD reported right before Flores lost control of the vehicle, she and Flores were going between 45 and 50 miles per hour as she followed close behind. Okay, I looked at the statements. First of all, I don't see her being interviewed at the scene. Am I wrong about that? I see a single statement. 3 days later.
They took a brief statement from her, and then longer transcribed interview is occurred after the incident.
Is that statement in the record? Her statement at the scene? I didn't see it, but I saw a description in the state. I saw both a description and a statement of her interview, but it was a description of the interview which we have. I didn't see a statement at the scene.
I guess maybe I'm wrong. No, in that sense, you're right, Your Honor. I don't believe there was no transcribed statement at the scene. I think the only thing in the record is the officer relaying what she told him.
Right. But the only thing I see in that, and this is, it's just important in terms of, because it really is what the evidence is. And there's a police report that describes what she said on December 2nd. Okay. The statement. So there's a statement and a description, but then the reports from the scene, all I saw was an officer saying he didn't have a chance to talk, but maybe I'm wrong and it's there. But I'm just wondering why we couldn't find it anyway. All right. So then we get to like where the 55 miles per hour was. And this district court decided that the maximum 55 miles per hour was 1 to 2 miles before the spin out. And that at the spin out, Flores was going 45 to 50. Do you agree? Is that accurate in your view of what she said? Is the district court correct? Because you're talking about 55 miles per hour, and I'm wondering what you say the evidence is about where he was traveling 55 miles per hour, I guess.
I agree with Your Honor that it's important, and here's my understanding of the record. Pulling from CD's statements, pulling from just the geographical realities, if the court Google maps it, comparing that versus what her statement was to police officers, here's my understanding, is that after the Highway 10 overpass, the speed limit goes up to 55. She tells officers that she increases her speed to 50 miles per hour. And she says that at that point in time, he sped up to get in front of her. So relationally speaking, she in effect tells officers he's now traveling more than 50 miles per hour. She never says that he's speeding. I believe we can concede on the record that there's no evidence that he was speeding excessively. I think with the evidence in the record, taking all inferences in favor of the state, is that he was traveling between 50 to 55 plus miles per hour. That's what the record shows.
At the time of the spin out or earlier?
At the time of the spin out. And
so when the district court says at the time of the spin out, the only evidence from her is that he was going 45 to 50 miles per hour as she followed closely behind, you wouldn't agree that that's what the evidence is. In other words, what paragraph 8 in the conclusions of law, you would not agree is accurate.
Correct. I think that what the evidence shows is that he was traveling up to 55 or more miles per hour. And again, you know, CD's testimony, personal testimony, is only one piece of the evidence. And that is the point that I would like to make, is that all the other circumstantial evidence, A, it rounds out her firsthand, you know, personal witness statement to the officers, but it also proves that what she saw was both traveling faster than the weather required or would have
safely prudent. I had one other question following up on Judge Smith's excellent questions about the speeding. So when she saw him the first time kind of swerve into the other lane, my question is, A, at that point in time, what is the evidence that this was the speed limit and what was the evidence of how fast he was going?
The evidence shows that before the Highway 10 overpass, he was not speeding. There's no evidence that he was speeding before that.
Okay. Does the evidence indicate what the speed limit was at that point? Because it sounds like at some point you said the speed limit goes up to 55.
Yes.
So presumably it was less than 55.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't remember the exact pin site, but I do know in the record.
Here's my point. Let's say for the sake of argument, I don't know, everything's 20 miles an hour now in Minneapolis, but presumably Anoka is still 30. I mean, isn't your best argument as to gross negligence is, well, if he was going the speed limit of 30 miles an hour and swerved in the other lane, wouldn't that put him on notice that, well, boy, if I'm losing control at 30, the average person would say going to 55 is not the plan. I should be going down to 10. So isn't that your best argument in terms of gross negligence? Just as if I'm on notice that my brakes don't work, I shouldn't be driving with my brakes. If I'm on notice that the lower speed caused that I was the lower at 30, I'm swerving. Then shouldn't I be on notice that, well, gee, 55 probably going to be worse. I mean, I didn't see your argument that, but that struck me as being sort of because then we get into this debate about, you know, how fast should you go in a blizzard in Anoka? And, you know, I don't know. But that seems to be a better argument as to gross negligence versus the hamburger and, you know, all the other stuff. What do you think of that?
I absolutely think Your Honor's right. And the timeline here in obviously.
Well, thank God, you know, there's nothing like hitting a softball right out of the park. You know, you should be at the Twins tomorrow. So, okay.
Yeah, maybe I'll get drafted, Your Honor. But no, and I think the timeline is appropriate there. And it's really telling because, you know, like I said, there's two major sets of factors here. There's the distracted driving and then the speeding but going too fast. And it's important to Your Honor's point that, you know, the order that happened is that he was seen distractedly driving, swerving in, jolting in. And then he's having a hard time driving. And so then instead of doing what Your Honor described as, you know, being placed on notice that there's inclement weather, and he should probably slow down. He did the exact opposite. He sped up. That's the important language that CD said, is that he sped up to pass her. And at the same time, as she was increasing her speed, a reasonably prudent person in that situation for purposes of the case, CD realized that that was too fast. And so she started to pull back from that speed. And so the timeline here, and again, that's why her firsthand observations is the keystone of the case. Now, I also want to briefly address the fact that the other, with regard to the speeding that was immediately happening, or I'm sorry, not speeding, but the speed that he was traveling immediately leading up to the incident. The respective and relative information here also favors the state as showing gross negligence or at minimum negligence leading up to that, in that mile leading up to the incident. One thing that was pointed out in respondent's brief is that appellant claimed that taking all evidence in favor of the state, that the Defendant here, Mr. Flores, was potentially traveling up to 15 miles an hour faster than the victim. That comes from the victim's statement given to the police officers that on the day in question, he was traveling between 40 and 45 miles an hour. That's where that comes from. And that is amply supported in the record. And what that shows is that you have the defendant now traveling up to 15 miles an hour faster than the victim. That is telling. And, and even if he was not speeding, that favors gross negligence or at minimum negligence. And then additionally, there were six vehicles that were present at the incident. One was Mr. Flores's, one was CD's, and then there's the four vehicles traveling westbound. Three of the witnesses independently gave statements to the officers saying that people were driving too fast for the inclement weather. The vehicle in front of the victim's car stated that he was traveling too fast. The 2016 Silverado behind used the language driving too fast, and CD said that she pulled back a little because of the weather. And so given that timeline and the speeding, or not speeding, but the speed he was traveling at, that amply supports a finding of gross negligence or negligence. And I'll reserve the rest of my time unless the court has any questions for rebuttal.
Thank you. Counsel for the respondent, you may proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Mark Berglund. I represent the respondent in this matter, Pedro Ricardo Flores, or Rick Flores. This obviously stems from a very tragic and horrible case that has a horrible outcome no matter what we decide here today. Regardless of whether or not the Court of Appeals upholds the lower court's decision or not, it won't undo the fact that there was a horrible loss here. The victims lost their son, suffered some major injury. And it's also true that no matter what the outcome, Mr. Flores will continue to feel horrible about what happened now and for the rest of his life as well, having been involved in this terrible accident. That said, the state is asking the Court of Appeals to overrule the district court's well-reasoned and well-founded decision in concluding that there was not evidence in the record to support probable cause that the defendant, respondent, was driving grossly negligently or negligently on the date of this accident. And the state is asking the Court of Appeals to determine that the lower court erred in its judgment in not allowing Mr. Flores to stand trial on the criminal vehicular operation charges that the state brought against him. In order for the state to convince the Court of Appeals to do that, it must demonstrate clearly and unequivocally that the district court did, in fact, err in its judgment. And this court is to give considerable but not unlimited deference to the trial court's fact-specific determination. And of course, in reviewing the lower court's decision about whether probable cause existed, the facts must lead a person of ordinary care and prudence to hold an honest and strong suspicion that the person under consideration is guilty. I propose to the court that Judge Fountain Lindberg is a person of ordinary care and prudence, and that we now know that she did not hold a strong and honest suspicion that Mr. Flores should stand trial for the criminal vehicular operation charges.
Mr. Berglund, may I ask you if we focus on the testimony from CD, which I think is what most tried to... was being relied on to pinpoint the speed at which Mr. Flores was driving.
Yes.
And all evidence needs to be taken in light most favorable to the state at this stage, you would agree. Can you answer my questions about the court's deciding that, I guess, the undisputed evidence is that, or even favoring the state, is that Mr. Flores was only going 45 to 50 miles per hour at the time of the incident? I mean, I'm confused about that when CD had said both up to 55 at one point and then 45 to 50 at another point. Why wouldn't 55 be the potential upper limit?
I understand the court's question. And I think part of what's important about what the court's trying to dissect here is that statement itself in the reading of that statement. I mean, when the state takes the statement, puts it in paragraph form into its written argument, it makes the statement look a lot more clear and concise than it actually is. Now, mind you, this is a layperson who was giving a statement, as the court pointed out, at least the transcribed statement that talks about at that point, and when the transcribed statement is given, that the defendant may have been traveling was traveling 50, quote, maybe 55 miles an hour was several days after the accident had occurred, and is being asked these questions by law enforcement that need to be read in conjunction with the answer that's given. So what the
but it sort of sounds like the district court you're asking to decide factually what the witness meant and take into account credibility because it's been a couple of days, et cetera, which is that really the right approach at probable cause?
I understand again what the court is asking, and I'm trying to reach the or explain why I believe what the court concluded and why that supports her findings is that ultimately what the court said is regardless of weighing credibility of that witness, the court concluded that that witness said possibly that the defendant was traveling 55 miles an hour. So the court says in light most favorable to the state that the defendant was traveling 55 miles an hour. And at that point, the defendant is not speeding if he's traveling 55 miles an hour.
The court also said, though, that was in a factual findings. But when we get to the court's analysis, and I think this is important because there's no other driver around that's traveling 55 in the evidence that's presented. In other words, he's the fastest driver of all of the people whose speed is known. And so if it's 55, right? I mean, there was no one going 55. When we get to the court's analysis, although I understand that the court said factually, you know, in earlier in its factual findings, that the analysis says that he was going 45 to 50 based on her testimony. And then later says, actually, in that next in paragraph 9 on addendum 6 and 7, that she didn't appear to be concerned as she followed him closely. I also had a question about that because I've done a word search. I can't find the word closely anywhere in her statement. She says she was right behind him, but that doesn't tell me. I don't know what is meant by that. In other words, there might have been no one between him, or it might have been that it was physically close. And so it seems like there is some potential factual finding here as opposed to taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the state.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Judge. The way I interpret it was the court ultimately indicating that taking the facts in the light most favorable to the state, the defendant was traveling at a speed of 55 miles an hour at the highest. And if that were the case, that the defendant was not speeding. I mean, and so therefore the court concluded that the defendant was not driving in a negligent or grossly negligent manner. Now,
what about the too fast for conditions? That's where I think the relative speed comes up in the conclusion number paragraph 8 and addendum 6, that if he's going 45 to 50 and the others are going around 50, that, you know, based on at least the people around him, he wasn't traveling too fast for conditions.
And you know, I believe in my reading of the record, as well as the court, the lower court's opinion, is that if again, in the light most favorable to the state, the defendant's traveling at 55 miles an hour. He's not speeding. Okay. The other vehicles are with the two vehicles that have a known speed are traveling at 50 and 46 miles per hour. There's indication that from the testimony of CD that she refers to how fast we were traveling and indicates that she was traveling at approximately the same speed as the defendant until he. And this is important too, as far as the record is concerned, and the way it's understood is that at the point that the defendant speeds up to go in front of CD, it's where the road literally changes from three lanes of traffic down to two lanes of traffic. And so he's increasing his speed to get in front of her so as to properly merge into the lane in front of her. And again, with the way the court discusses that, she indicates that when CD is talking about the defendant going 55 miles an hour, potentially in the light most favorable to the state, it's at that point in time. And then, as you pointed out, Judge, she concludes later in her analysis that at the time of the spin out, he was going 45 to 50 miles an hour.
Can I ask you, because you mentioned like the merge, there are three lanes. Is she in the right lane? And where's the merge lane? And why does he need to go in front of her? Does he speed past her from the merge lane into her lane? Or does he come around on the, I don't even know if the merge lane is on the right or the left. Can you just describe that to me?
Sure. It's my understanding, Judge, that the merge lane is, the lane that's being eliminated is in the right-hand lane. It's being eliminated. So that's the merge lane coming into So he's in the farthest right lane, and the two lanes that are going to continue are the middle and the farthest left lane. And so he's in the farthest right lane, and he merges from right one lane over left because they're traveling eastbound on Main Street. And he's coming, he enters onto, actually they both do, but they, he enters onto Main Street from what would be the south to go east. Is that, hopefully that answers your question, Judge.
Mr. Berglund, do you agree that that the evidence shows your client was at a lesser speed when this woman saw him swerve into the other lane than when, and that he was going at a higher speed later before the accident? I mean, is that a correct rendition of the evidence?
That's what I believe her statement indicates. Okay. Yes.
So, I mean, you know, we can all get a debate about gross negligence versus, you know, ordinary negligence, and looking at Bolsinger, you know, but I guess for me, you know, in a snowstorm, if you're going at a lower speed and you almost swerve into oncoming traffic, why doesn't that put you on notice, or at least enough to go to a jury, that you shouldn't be going then, you shouldn't be speeding up? I mean, it seems to me you would be more likely to really have something go bad if, based on that scenario, you then speed up versus to slow down. And I guess for me, that sort of notice, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, might be enough to say, yeah, that's enough to get to a jury on gross negligence. Why, who would speed up when you almost, you know, my words, not yours, who would speed up when I almost died going at 25 miles an hour in a snowstorm? So by God, let's go 50 and see what really happens. Okay. Why am I wrong on that?
I have a couple responses to that, Judge, and I was thinking of them, obviously, when you're asking counsel the same question. First of all, my understanding of the evidence in the Google Maps and so forth is the lanes, are, the speed of travel along Main Street as you travel in the direction they were going, which was eastbound, it goes from when you're downtown, if the court is familiar, Main Street runs from Main Street, Anoka, all the way into the city of Blaine. And so when you're downtown Anoka, you're 30 miles an hour. As you're coming over to Highway 10, you're going 40 to 50 miles an hour, and then it increases to 55. It didn't go from 25 miles to 55 miles an hour like that. It was the staggered increase. And so the speeding up was going from essentially 50 to 55. That's it. Now, the second thought I had about that, Judge, was that the state does talk about and points out CD's discussion about him swerving or pulling back in the attempt to merge from one lane to the next. The state doesn't attribute that to the fact that his vehicle is, I mean, it doesn't say it anywhere in their argument, at least, that that's because the vehicle was traveling too fast for conditions at that point. It's more related to this speculation that he was either chewing on a hamburger or that he was driving like he was talking on a phone. So that swerving conduct is never argued that that was because at that point in time he was swerving out of control of his vehicle. I don't think CD states that either. So that's the view then is that at that point in time he wasn't swerving because of the weather. At least the argument from the state is because of these other things that were distracting his driving. I mean, as the lower court points out and the evidence suggests, is that the loss of control of the vehicle was instantaneous. It happened very, very quickly. And not only did that did the defendant not have time to react, but it happened so quickly that it may have even caused his vehicle to start moving sideways instantaneously and so forth. What is interesting about all of this, as we discuss it, is that the state and law enforcement for this particular incident had all the evidence necessary to gather right before them at the time that this incident occurred. This wasn't a situation where a victim is found in the woods after being gone missing for 5 weeks, and then the state has to piece together potential circumstantial evidence to figure out who done it. All the evidence was there, and photographs were taken, witnesses were known, statements could be gathered. And the state trooper on scene in his accident report indicates that the defendant was not speeding and the defendant was not distracted. That's indicated right there at the time that the incident occurred. The state's statement of probable cause and its complaint quotes or attributes to the accident reconstructionist language that the defendant that she indicated the defendant was traveling 50.
Yeah, Mr. Berkman, I think Judge Larkin has a question. Thank you.
I just, before you get to the end of your time, I don't think you've answered Judge Connolly's questions. I appreciate the, you know, explaining what the variations in speed limits are, but I think the gist of his question is, if you're driving a pickup and fishtailing already in inclement weather, could it not reasonably show negligence, gross or otherwise, if you, instead of slowing down, speed up? Regardless of what the speed limit is and regardless of the incremental increase in speed limits, especially when you're coming upon a bridge, when bridges are typically known to be the icier risks, if you're a Minnesota driver.
Yeah. If the evidence had indicated that the vehicle was fishtailing, quote unquote, fishtailing, and a driver knows that they're fishtailing, a driver would be expected to slow down rather than speed up. My position, according to my review of the record, is that the defendant was not fishtailing, and that's not what CD was indicating at the time that that description occurred. So with that, I thank the court for its time and ask that the court conclude that the lower court was proper in its decision and its determinations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. I hope I pronounced it right. Is it Yount?
Yes, Your Honor.
You'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. From between 1 to 2 minutes before the incident happened, CD observed what she described as distracted driving. It looked like he was on his phone. He was drifting over the lanes. It looked like he was having a hard time driving, or he wasn't driving with due diligence. After not driving with apparent due diligence, as this court has pointed out, and I think it's important, he then decided to speed up. He sped past her after the Highway 10 intersection. That almost on its face would show negligence, and it would definitely contribute to gross negligence. But in addition to that distracted driving, that we haven't talked about it, and it's not the strongest piece of evidence, but it is a piece of evidence, is that it appeared like he was eating at or near the time leading up to the incident. That's what the circumstantial evidence shows, is that he was eating in the car while his car was drifting over the line. In addition to that, that's when he started to speed up and become one of the fastest vehicles on the road. That's what the evidence shows. CD pulled back because she felt that 50 miles per hour was too fast. The victim testified that he was going between 40 and 45 miles per hour. The Chevy Silverado that rear-ended the victim, he said that that people were driving too fast, and the reconstructionist found that he was traveling about 50 miles per hour. So you already have another truck on the road in the similar conditions that's heading westbound that is traveling slower than 55 miles per hour and admits that people were driving too fast, arguably himself. So just in that limited universe of firsthand eyewitness statements, you have not necessarily that he's excessively speeding, but that's also not what the law requires, just that he's traveling too fast for the conditions.
I asked counsel about the inattentiveness argument. And this is basically what does probable cause determination mean when we're talking about circumstantial evidence cases, if you could help with that. If we got to the end, for example, we got to the end of this case and we're looking at sufficiency of the evidence, the only issue was inattentiveness. Could a jury reasonably conclude, based on a partially eaten burger bought, like it seems like a half hour to an hour previously, and 1 to 2 miles before the incident, encroaching on a lane twice, could a jury reasonably conclude that the driver was inattentive at the time of the accident? And maybe you would argue, yes, you could. if a court were to think, no, that's not, that wouldn't satisfy it. What does that mean with respect to probable cause that a jury could probably not reasonably, I mean, reasonably find? How does that fit together?
I think that's a wise way to think about this, Your Honor, for two reasons. One, some of the cases cited in the brief did, on their procedural posture on appeal, was that there was sufficiency of the evidence or challenging a verdict. I would direct the court's attention to State v. Van Tassel, because that one, they actually reversed a trial verdict. And that shows that on much thinner facts than are present here, that was not sufficient. The court went out of its way to note that the record did not show defendant was inattentive to the road, necessarily implying that if there's evidence of inattentiveness, that might have supported the verdict. In that Van Tassel case, it said that without more, speeding by itself is not gross negligence. Again, it's talking about how thin of a record it is, how in a vacuum, if you only have maybe one of these factors, speeding or inattentiveness, that might not be enough. What we have on the record at this probable cause challenge is evidence of both. And that's the distinction here. If all we had was evidence of a half-eaten burger, and maybe the fact that he drifted over the line once, but we don't have his speed increasing over the highway. We don't have the other individuals on the highway testifying that 55 miles per hour would have been too fast for the weather conditions. We might not be here. The charges might be different. But we are here on this more robust record than what previous courts have found. And as to Your Honor's point about circumstantial evidence, I think that it's important. In State v. Kistner, this court specifically acknowledged that circumstantial evidence is sufficient to support a verdict for these types of crimes. More specifically, in State v. Hagstrom, and I think this is a direct quote, but it was error to weigh an eyewitness account against the state's evidence on a probable cause challenge and to require, quote, hard evidence that the defendant was, quote, distracted for a long period of time. That type of evidence on a Rule 11 probable cause challenge is not necessary. What is sufficient is circumstantial evidence showing that he was traveling too fast for the weather conditions, and circumstantial evidence showing that he was inattentive and not, or potentially driving distractedly. And again, taking all the evidence in the record in favor of the state, that amply shows negligence, and it shows, and it could lead to a reasonable probability of a finding of gross negligence. And so at minimum, this court should reverse the negligence charges, and the state believes it should also reverse the gross negligence charges. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days.